Welcome to PharmaTalk Radio, a nonprofit program to disseminate helpful information to the life science and patient advocacy communities. I'm Annalie Smith, Marketing Manager of the Partnership Opportunities in Drug Delivery, or POD, program. At POD 2017, the CEO keynote was a fireside chat between Lars Rebien Sorensen and Dr. Barbara Lueckel. Sorensen is the former president and CEO of Novo Nordisk, and Dr. Lueckel is the Global Business Development Director of Roche Partnering Innovation. Sorensen ranked as the world's top-performing CEO in 2015 and 2016 by Harvard Business Review, and he led Novo Nordisk to being pioneers within the drug delivery space. We were delighted to have him join us at POD 2017. Now, here is their conversation.
All right, good morning. Great to be back on day two. I'll jump right in because we lost a little bit of time with starting the event. And as I featured innovation in approved product yesterday, I will take a very brief glimpse on deal making ever since the last pod. And you don't need to take pictures. I'm happy to put those slides later on the website. So my analysis bears no claim to be completely comprehensive. It may be very subjective, and I'm trying to figure out sort of where were the key topics ever since October last year. Again, not to a surprise, still a lot of deal-making happening in the area of peptide delivery, and Teris Peptelligence technology was used with a number of companies, key biosciences, for their Ducra peptides that I think have by now been licensed by Lilly, as well as early preclinical diabetes peptides by Sanofi, and also a collaboration with Ferring. In general, Ferring was very active with its peptide portfolio, striking collaborations with depot companies, some very specific for local delivery to the cancer, like LIDD's nano-Zulit approach. It's also interesting to see quite a courageous foray into the area of pulmonary delivery of other modalities than the known small molecules. AZ and Pieris are working on inhaled anticalines, which is a smaller protein scaffold format. AZ also struck a collaboration with Etris, which is a German messenger RNA company, to deliver this new emerging modality to the lung. And then Dynavax is a company that specializes in oligo-based TLR agonists. They do have a TLR9 for asthma in the clinic with AZ in phase two. And now they also develop one for localized delivery to the lung for lung cancer, in this case working with Vectura's delivery device. And finally, Mount Sinai and Theragene enter the area of inhaled gene therapy for a complicated disease like pulmonary hypertension, replacing a protein called SERCA2 by delivering the gene vector. Ocular drug delivery, which we will hear more of today, this time around actually covers the full slide from acquisitions like Genentech Roche's acquisitions of Foresight, which is a port delivery system that's implanted into the pars plana, and our Lucentis Ladder phase 2 trial is ongoing. As you see here, it's not just big pharma that strikes deals these days with delivery companies, but also smaller companies. Area is obviously very focused on ocular products, both front and back to the eye, using ROCK inhibitors. They acquired basically the entire application of Liquidia's PRINT technology for ophthalmology from Invisia, and also DSM polymer to use in ophthalmology. Daiichi evaluates Prolink's linker technology, and Nemos, which focuses on CB1, CB2 inhibitors for diseases in the eye, is teaming up with UK-based Nanomeric molecular envelope technology for topical delivery to glaucoma. And last but not least, on top of what we heard in of the gene therapy approach by Sparks, which has already good feedback from the FDA advisory group, Allergan has entered the field of gene editing programs, teaming up with Editas. I think we will hear more later on, but nanotechnology, which has been a buzzword in a way for a while, is really showing great impact on pharmaceutical development. Selecta, which has also presented a number of times here at POT, is really having a lot of collaborations with gene therapy companies or proteins, including their own gout program, to reduce immunogenicity of these molecules. And another approach in the field of immune tolerance for nanoparticles is the deal that Eli Lilly struck with German-based Topaz Therapeutics, where they basically harness our natural mechanism of the liver to promote immune tolerance. And in this case, peptide nanoparticles will be should be taken up by liver sinusoidal endothelial cells, which present the antigens to T cells and induce the formation of T regulatory cells. In that very same space, again, Tolerantia, which works on specific tolerogens, did strike a deal with Tecrea for their nanoparticles for an important autoimmune disease called myasthenia gravis. And last but not least, the targeted delivery for cancer using nanoparticles is making strides. We had BIND, now taken up by Pfizer, present at POT, looking to see how their programs advance. Star Pharma is progressing their docetaxel into phase two, as the same is true for Crystal Therapeutics, being present here, starting that early next year. Star Pharma also reported their last preclinical milestone of their alliance with AstraZeneca on their BCL2XL inhibitor. And last but not least, Crystal Therapeutics did strike a partnership with iTeo Therapeutics in Europe, which is a company that doesn't work in the classical small molecule cancer inhibitor field, but actually in immuno-oncology. So that's an even new way to tackle immune activation to fight cancer using nanotechnology. And we very much look forward to hearing more on the nanotechnology field when we ask Omid for Roxad to come on stage at 9:30. So this was a really quick run through, and it's now my pleasure to introduce my 9 o'clock fireside chat partner. A very special guest already announced by Valerie, Lars Sørensen. He actually joined Novo Nordisk in 1982 in the enzymes marketing group and has been the CEO from 2000 until he retired last year. He's still on the board of directors of numerous companies, including the Novo Nordisk Foundation. And for all the innovative products that were approved that I showed on my slides yesterday, he has seen the initiation and progress of all of those. And I'm very happy to now interact with him in a dialogue on all the delivery that has happened for Novo's different therapeutic areas. This will be a fireside chat without slides, believe it or not. And we have a lot of questions to cover, but I will look into the crowd here and see if you have any questions you want to ask yourself. Lars is up for any question, the most controversial one, just please don't shy away. And with that, Lars, please come on stage. Left.
Good morning.
Good morning, Lars.
It is a bit early for a fireside talk, I have to admit. But we are on European time, so we are a little bit better off than the rest of you, perhaps. And thanks to Valerie for the nice testimonial from one person. A patient that has taken advantage of some of the things we do. This is what it's all about. And this is also what my life has been all about, working for Novo Nordisk, except for the first years where I worked for an industrial enzyme division, which is now a separate company that was spun out from Novo Nordisk in 2000 when I became CEO. Just by way of expectation management, I'm not a scientist, and my experience is totally, entirely related to the activities which we have done at Novo Nordisk. And this means when I pass comments on various technologies that you may be working on and discarding them, this does not mean that they are irrelevant. They may be fantastic in other applications, but just that we did not perhaps find that technology relevant for our usage. And at just 1 minute on Novo Nordisk, we are a biopharmaceutical company, and we've manufactured insulin and growth hormone initially from extracted either animal or human tissue. Then for a long period of time, that was the only way to do it. And so the way to get an appropriate pharmacological profile was to either protract the working of the protein by formulation. So it's, in a way, a depot type of formulation. Then eventually came a recombinant technology that allowed us to get rid of either human or animal material and produce insulin and growth hormone in infinite quantities. Insulin was the first recombinantly expressed human therapeutics, and I believe that growth hormone was the second. And so this led to an ability to produce highly purified therapeutic proteins. And then came the next development, which was our ability to make modifications to these proteins, slight modifications, so that they did not become immunogenic, but that their absorption was altered, either to become ultra-rapid or to be attached to albumin, thereby protracting their circulation in the bloodstream, or in other ways associate, self-associate, and thereby being slowly released. So from all of this, you can already get the notion that our primary way of improving therapy for the patients has been through the molecular approach. But since, even today, therapy in diabetes has to be accompanied with multiple daily injections, we've also, over time, developed delivery systems, primarily pen systems, and I had the pleasure of visiting some of the manufacturers out here before this talk and see what they are offering. We are an in-house manufacturer of pens. We tried pumps. We failed. And we were not very good at that, so others are making pumps. But so that's basically the experience that I represent. And Barbara, mm-hmm. I'm looking forward to chat with you.
Me too. With your broad portfolio of proteins and peptides and the delivery approaches that you chose, what were the primary drivers for those?
The primary drivers were absorption to ensure that we could get the drug into the patient, and then the pharmacodynamic profile, so that we, because for diabetics, you need to mimic the physiological state, which basically means you, for maintenance, need a completely flat profile of insulin circulating. And then when you have a meal or there's a requirement for additional glucose, then you need to have a bolus. And the best way to achieve this is through multiple injections or through pumps. But it's primarily the clinical efficacy and availability for the patient that's important for us.
And you already alluded to the fact that you very much focused on modifying the molecule rather than trying different formulations.
Yes.
And if you look at the product also, it's a very sophisticated platform around this fatty acid conjugation to modify the reversible binding to albumin. Mm-hmm. What was the real driver to focus on that particular avenue? And I guess actually doing a lot of this in-house as opposed to quite broad universe of even formulation options being available,
yeah,
or other conjugation options.
Yeah, it's, I mean, we've had over the years contact with many of the companies, I think, represented here, looking at their technologies. There is, in a way, an obvious advantage in doing the molecular approach in that you can patent these entities, so you get a very a proprietary situation in the marketplace, and this we felt were more attractive. There's also, when you make administration systems like we make it, if you can alter the molecule, you don't have to formulate very viscous emulsions of the proteins. And because when you have to do that, then you end up in situations where you have the big needles, and it's quite unpleasant for the patient experience. So we felt all of that taken into consideration, the ability to deliver something which was more appropriate for the therapy, creating a patent estate and a platform that can be used. And it's actually exemplified by the technology that we developed for insulins to protract insulins. We have now applied on GLP-1, which is the new buzz word in diabetes, a gut hormone, where the human equivalent is only active in minutes, and therefore it needs serious protraction, and we could use the platform from diabetes or from insulins to GLP-1. And we hope that we can use it yet for other hormones that should be identified.
You shared last night with me a story about scientists who, you know, perfecting a platform, always come up with yet another molecule. So you, as the CEO of the company, like, when do you actually say, let's go down this path, let's zoom in on this molecule, and you don't look back and see maybe yet another molecule? How is that decision making for you in particular as a CEO?
It's interesting. We talked about GLP-1. The product that we have on the market in the U.S. is called Victoza. It's human GLP-1, but slightly altered with the fatty acids to make it longer acting. But at the time when we were getting into the clinic, we already had the early stages of another protein, which just passed the FDA committee the other day. By being significantly more efficacious on blood sugar and weight and cardiovascular profile and all the rest of it. But we had, the perfect is the enemy of the good. And if we had waited for that, then they would have found another one and they would never finish. This is the nature of science. So, I guess it's just you say, okay, enough. Also, I would say we were, for competitive reasons, we needed a product on the market. Lilly was ahead of us with exenatide. And so that was a clarifying thing also in the decision process.
Was it tough to enforce, in a way, the route of molecular modification as opposed to trying out maybe still a formulation approach, maybe requiring a device that's maybe having a larger needle or is more complicated? Because you could argue that if you have a peptide made, and this is your NCE, you can do a lot with bridging studies to come up with a controlled release formulation. So you may be faster. So how did you manage the two?
Well, the first one that I saw, and there may be others, was the Genentech growth hormone depot formulation, and what I saw using that was burst phenomenon, and I felt that was rather unattractive. Then I felt also, for the reasons just discussed, that the viscousness meant that it had to be applied with a gauge 27 or 28 needle, which was not very attractive for a small child. So my view have always been that taking a daily injection is probably, at the end, more safe, more consistent in clinical profile. But of course, we are trying to then, by molecular means, extend the release so that we can get to once weekly or even longer. So you have to understand, our scientists have, by and large, only worked on one molecule. There's the insulin molecule. It's all they think of. It's all they get up in the morning and they, what can we do with this molecule? Just as an example, it was always believed that you could not find a non-invasive route for administration of insulin. We tried with one of our gentlemen down here from former Pfizer to inhale insulin, and this was it was my mistake. But I would share hands with Pfizer in that if Pfizer hadn't pursued it, then we probably wouldn't either. Because inhaling growth factors into the lungs is somewhat you should be somewhat careful with. And so we spent a lot of money on that in trying to achieve a non-invasive administration form. But in reality, when we got to the marketplace, short of any safety issues, diabetes therapy had changed. And the way you initiate insulin therapy is by a basal insulin, a long-acting basal insulin. And what we were giving the patients was a meal-related insulin. So the therapy was wrong in the meantime. So what we have then been able to do is actually make insulin available orally. So this is probably one of the, I would say scientifically, one of the biggest advances we've achieved. Because when we shelved the pulmonary administration, I told the staff, then you're gonna have to make a pill. And they said, the head of research, the head of diabetes research said, cannot be done. But it was an international meeting where we had as many people as we have here. And there's of course always somebody in the audience that says, well, maybe we can do it anyway. And so we found a way of doing it. But in the meantime, again here, insulin therapy and initiation with basal insulins, what can we offer with a tablet? We can replace an injection with a very thin needle. And is the payers going to be willing to pay a significant premium that it would cost? I doubt it, so we said, let's put it on the shelf, even though it's fantastic results, until we get a better bioavailability and can find other ways of, that might be formulation that is required or conjugates that would work better in the intestinal absorption. So it largely comes from the molecule.
So you haven't given up on oral, though, right? I mean,
no.
You read about oral Zema once you have.
Yeah, that's the thing. That's the thing that it seems like GLP-1, which our molecule is called semaglutide, lends itself better than insulin for oral administration. Also obvious in the sense that GLP-1 has a very wide therapeutic window, whereas insulin has a very narrow one, and you've got to be very, very cautious. So we are actually in clinical trials with an oral version of semaglutide that was just passed at least the ADCOM meeting earlier this week. So this with a view to make this kind of therapy available in a non-invasive form, both for early type 2 diabetes, but eventually also for obesity in 4 or 5 years' time.
And in a market like diabetes, there's one or two key competitors. How difficult it is to embark on these routes which take a long time, whether it's oral or weekly, and sort of trying to figure out when can in this case, Novo be still first? So what's the competition doing, acknowledging that all of these efforts will take a long time?
Well, we were not always the first. I mean, I would actually argue that we were second in the time that I was involved. But then recently, we've started to come first. But the idea was that we would. It's okay to be second if you come with the best molecule. So it may be also a reflection of the history of the company that I think the company were very, very good at science, but less good at development and commercialization. So we were a very science-driven organization. And it's interesting looking back at history. We were the first to develop analogs of insulin, but it was Lilly that was first to commercialize short-acting analogs. It was Sanofi that was first to commercialize long-acting analogs. It was Lilly that was first to commercialize GLP-1 by using the Gila monster exenatide. So we couldn't go that route, but on the other hand, we were working actually with small biotech company and Mass General Hospital on human GLP-1. And it was much more difficult because of the precariousness of the molecule to make a drug out of it. But when we finally did, then we have the development that we see today. So, you know, you gotta, and it doesn't matter whether, I mean, there is always gonna be competition. As long as the field is moving forward with science, improving therapy, you will eventually be able to get a meaningful position in the marketplace. Where trouble emerges is when science dry out and the only way to compete is by competing on price. This is where things get slightly more complicated.
So also in the quite competitive field of weekly growth hormones, you're pretty confident in terms of the, again, science that Novo brings to the table, recognizing, I think right now we have four players, including Novo.
I would always be confident. I would always be optimistic, let me put it that way, that we will be able to come up with. I don't know how meaningful it will be, though. It's probably likely more going to be a competitive battle than a clinical advance. I think Valerie would agree that with the new devices and the small needles, once you have injected yourself once, this is a non-issue, really, because the needles are so thin. For diabetics, the blood glucose monitoring is far more cumbersome than injecting, I would argue. So, but let's see. I mean, there will be competition there for sure.
Is it then actually competition, just like with the pulmonary example, that drives a decision to not give up a certain
yes.
path, so not
in,
to
in
miss
this,
out?
In the case of long-acting growth hormone, I was all, and maybe it's good that I left, I was always of the opinion that daily injections were good for the patients. And once they get used to it, it's fine. If you have to protract it and it becomes a more viscous formulation and you end up with bigger needles, then I don't think the advance is there. But I'm no longer involved, so I can be allowed to say whatever I want.
All right. Before we move on to partnering aspects, acknowledging that a lot of science obviously happens in-house, which may not make it easier.
Well, also in collaboration with academia and smaller biotech companies, we don't invent everything ourselves.
But during your time difficult to convince scientists of the value of working with partners while having a strong internal...
No, but we were, I mean, I don't know, we were so proud and so stingy that when we were presented with alternative approaches, I mean, and you know how pricing of biotechs deals have been and is at the moment. We often asked our people, so why don't you do it yourself? Can you do it for half the price or whatever? And oftentimes they could. And they were better and better the more competition there were and the more external approaches was presented. That really made them work fast. But I mean, we could not have done all the things that we do without collaboration. It's just that we enter into the collaborations very, very early because that's where we feel we can justify the value. And then from there on, we put it into our development machine, make them more druggable, add the administration systems to it, and there we go. But I feel like, for instance, hemophilia, where we're also playing in replacing lagging clotting factors, it's not a field we've been in for so long. There we are looking for collaborations, and right now we are behind some of the wonderful science coming out of your company, Roche Chugai, which we completely missed. So there we should probably have been more open.
Can you speak to some of the more successful collaborations where you said you took them on very early on?
Yeah, I think the GLP-1 area was a very, very interesting one in that it was a collaboration, I think, if I'm not mistaken, it was started before my time, but Skyos was a company here, a small biotech company in here, that work together with Mass General Hospital on human GLP-1. And it was a torturous collaboration because it, technically it's very, very difficult to make the human GLP-1 druggable. And then all of a sudden, Syers was bought by Johnson & Johnson. And then all of a sudden, we had a partnership with a major gorilla, so to speak, excuse me the expression. And that then speeded up our diligence in going forward and eventually led to the drug. So that I would say, was a fruitful collaboration, which we then finalized ourselves.
Do you have any specific view what made that particular one successful versus others that didn't?
I think in general, you have to have an alignment of interests. And often when things goes wrong is if you take certain technology in for a certain indication and the biotech company keeps other indications and develop that with other partners. That is not a good, in our view, a good recipe for success, because that they may have different advance and they may have different value in different settings, and it's likely to mess up the future commercialization. Then often we find that because of lack of funds and in some cases skills, we have to redo a lot of the work to ensure that we can take the projects through the more rigorous regulatory phases. So if disclosure has not been completely transparent in the beginning, that can lead to some tension later on in the process. So it's better to disclose what you have and the shortcomings that you may have so that nobody has any surprises going forward. But there's always a difference in opinion about timelines and when we can go to the clinic. And usually our smaller partners have very ambitious timelines. And when we don't meet that because we have to do some workaround and some additional evaluations, then they get dissatisfied with us. And so it's not always easy.
Did you have, in your role as CEO, did you have to come in specific partnerships and...
No.
And resolve conflicts, or
no? That was very rare. I don't understand the science, and they try to keep me out of it, I think.
The contracts normally always say CEOs are there to de-escalate something.
So. No, yeah, but of course I would. When something was stopped in the tracks, I would be informed, but I don't think necessarily that I. There's only one case where I was able to solve an issue. I'd prefer not to speak about it in public, but that's only one case where we could leverage some of the other capabilities we had in the company to free up some so let's say conflict in another area. But that's it. No, I'm, this beyond my this is above my pay grade.
So when there is such a considerable amount of expertise in a company and yet smaller biotechs are come and offer whatever they have to become a partner of Novo, what was sort of the level of data that the team and then later on you needed to see to be really comfortable entering?
Well, normally, as I say, we would track the technology at a relatively early stage. Mm-hmm. So that would often be preclinical. And top management in our company, or I was not involved in technology assessment at preclinical level. We got involved, the whole management team got involved when it started to become clinical. And so you could say that we saw the results of our partnerships, or lack thereof, when it was stopped in its tracks clinically. Before that, it was entirely up to scientific assessment on the part of our researchers and our development people, whether they believed that they could make a druggable project and whether they could make a clinical program and that could create in advance for the patients, and then they were normally fortified with business development people like yourselves to make sure that there was also a market and that were freedom to operate and other important things. So it never really came to me early on. We later on then, when we got more and more alliances, built an office like yourselves that had the day-to-day contact with all our partners.
Just looking around whether anyone on the floor has any question triggered by this discussion. Yes, there is a mic here.
Yeah, Lars, it was wonderful to talk to you earlier today and discuss what we shared. And my name is Mac Jawadekar. I worked at Pfizer for 30 years and worked on Exubera. And so we shared the experience this morning.
We have scars on the back, both of us.
Exactly. So my question going forward is on the Spark Therapeutics, the one in the news where they got the advisory board, FDA advisory board, with 16-0. You know, they approved the, approved in the sense, they said go ahead with the ophthalmic delivery gene therapy. So my question to you is, do you see something like this happening for diabetes therapy, again, using some kind of a gene therapeutics?
I think gene therapy in diabetes, but this, due to my limited scientific background, is not very likely. Diabetes is a multigenetic condition. We have not seen any approaches. So we'd rather look at some of the underlying risk factors. And one obvious one is obesity. And so we're attacking it from the front of trying to see if we can develop a pharmacological intervention in obesity and thereby preventing the advance of type 2 diabetes. And then in relationship to type 1 diabetes, our approach is stem cells. We are quite advanced in a stem cell project where we have now a mammalian cell that can differentiate into beta cells that produce insulin in a meaningful fashion. It's glucose dependent. Mm-hmm. Now the next phase is to make sure that it's safe and then find out how we can encapsulate it and thereby enable it being transplanted into individuals with very, what we call, brittle type 1 diabetes that cannot really live a meaningful life even though they have pumps or devices with insulin. So we are observing, of course, gene therapy in the area of hemophilia. It looks like it's being restarted again and have a meaningful advance there. But we're not engaged ourselves. We are more on the observing front.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Any final question? All right. I think with that, I think it was actually interesting to end on the note of stem cells, which is a really completely different modality. And while we talk about innovation, this would be an interesting topic going forward for the disease areas also that Novo is involved
certainly.
In to see.
Certainly. Yeah. It is controversial for some audiences for ethical reasons, and it's just something you have to be mindful of. But as long as it's you're dealing with conditions like diabetes, brain injury, heart problems, I think you can justify working with, we are working with embryonic stem cells, which are, for some people, controversial. But I think the utility justifies that approach.
So looking forward to see the progress of that. And thanks a lot for sharing
the
insights this morning. Thank you, Lars.
Thanks for having me.
The 8th annual POD meeting will be on October 17th and 18th, 2018, in Boston. And we're pleased to welcome back Dr. Lukel as the program chair. You can learn more about POD online at www.theconferenceforum.org. Thanks for listening.